Okay, I'm here with William Remmers. Hello again, William. Welcome back.
Hey, David. Good to be here.
Yeah, definitely. Well, it's always great to have you on. For listeners who might be a little confused, if you're looking at the episode numbers, yes, this is episode 21 of Criterion Reflections, even though 22 has been in the can and out on the internet for a little while now. And that's just because I'm deciding to stick with the numerical order of the films as they were released chronologically, even if I have to record them out of order sometimes. Of course, the last time we recorded with Robert Taylor, along with William and myself, as we discussed Beyond the Valley of the Dolls, but in the big scheme of things, that's actually our next episode. So sorry for any cognitive dissonance that I might have inflicted on you, but yes, this is episode 21, Yoshitaro Nomura's The Shadow Within. This is one of those film-struck nuggets that we've dug up because we cover it all here on Criterion Reflections, and we're going to get into a little moody piece of Japanese melodrama with a little bit of a thriller, even slightly horror twist to it. William, you've had a chance to watch this. In fact, you were just telling me you watched this a little while ago, the same night that we recorded Beyond the Valley of the Dolls. Let's just maybe get a very quick opening take. What'd you think of this film?
This is a fantastic drama of a variety that I don't think I've gotten to see enough of, which is Japanese film, late 60s, early 70s, set in contemporary, at the time, Japan. I think that it explored a lot of aspects of day-to-day life, the life of actual adults, in a way that is, though stylized in some aspects, has a bit more of a realistic approach. I think a lot of the films of this era I've seen are probably Yakuza oriented, so it was nice to enjoy something that at its surface approach is basically a drama about a infidelity romance. So I thought it was something I had not really ever gotten to see, and it felt very, very fresh.
Yeah, very much ordinary middle-class people. In fact, there are some very specific time markers in the film that will place this like right on a particular date or week of 1969 as the story unfolds. But I wanted to say our approach to this film is going to be assuming that most listeners, at least many of our regular listeners, probably have not gotten around to watching this yet, unless you're the fastidious type who insists on watching the film before you bother listening to our episode. So we do want to give you at least a few minutes of spoiler-free background information to tell you a little bit about the director, who he was, and maybe kind of create a little bit of curiosity, a little bit of intrigue to say, hey, let's just check this out. Because I think it is worth kind of putting away or setting aside for a little bit, at least, some of the higher profile releases, the new Blu-rays, and of course Criterion's throwing all kinds of incredible awesome stuff at us on the shelves. I'm actually recording this on the evening of the semi-annual Barnes & Noble sale, so I'm sure a lot of us are going to be stocking up our inventory of unwatched discs very soon. But I think this is a pretty good little hour and a half diversion, like William says, to kind of get into a very contemporary of its moment slice of life from Japan. But let's start by talking about the director. Yoshitaro Nomura is certainly not a household name unless you're really deeply into Japanese genre cinema. And when I think about deep dives into Japanese genre cinema, there's one name that comes to mind, and that's my good friend Pablo Kanota. For veteran listeners of the Eclipse Viewer podcast, Pablo has been on a few of our episodes. He was on the Koryoshi Kurahara set and also the Nikatsu Noir. Pablo maybe is best remembered for having that kind of distinctive husky voice. He is a German man, and he is also a very deeply versed aficionado of Japanese film. And he made my acquaintance by email several years ago. We got talking, and I thought Pablo would be an excellent guest to really help us dig up the nuances on the lesser familiar Japanese directors. And so I contacted Pablo, even with the idea of possibly getting him on as a guest on this episode, but was not able to work out, and I'll kind of talk about that a little bit. But I do want to read an email that he sent me to kind of give me a little bit of background on Yoshitaro Nomura, and I really appreciate Pablo's doing this. So here is what he had to say. Yoshitaro Nomura was one of the most successful directors working for Shochiku Studios from 1951 through the 1980s. He was a versatile contract director who helmed films in every popular genre of contemporary Japanese cinema. However, he is primarily remembered as a director of crime procedurals today. His most acclaimed works were adaptations of famous author Saichi Matsumoto's crime novels, including the superb The Chase, 1958, Zero Focus, 1961, which can be streamed at Hulu. Of course, this is Pablo's take from Germany. Those two films, actually known as Stakeout in English here, and Zero Focus, are both available on Filmstruck. I've watched them both. They're both excellent and really very much worth the time as well. Then there's The Shadow Within, which we're going to be talking about in a few minutes. The legendary tearjerker Castle of Sand, 1974, and The Demon, a haunting film from 1978. So those two films will be on this podcast somewhere down the road. In adapting these novels for the silver screen, Nomura closely collaborated with screenwriter Shinobu Hashimoto, who you may know as the legendary author of Rashomon, Seven Samurai, and Harakiri. Common themes in all of these works include the deceitful nature of outward appearances the main protagonists often have to deal with, repressed traumas that threaten to dismantle the carefully constructed social facade of their everyday life. By the way, Hashimoto has turned 100 years old in April and is still alive and well as of June. He remains the single-handedly most influential screenwriter in the history of Japanese cinema and one of the few great artists of 20th century's golden age of cinema still alive today. Thus, the mystery in those films often comes from the uncanny dissonance between a person's public face and the inner demons and social injustices that lurk behind the mask of conformity. Conveniently, Nomura's films also usually contain social commentary and are quite openly critical of some of the injustices that often get swept under the rug when discussing Japan's post-war development, such as the mistreatment of people with physical illnesses, as in The Castle of Sand, and the prevailing inequality of women, as in The Chase, a.k.a. Stakeout. For his choice of subject matter, Nomura is sometimes called the Japanese Alfred Hitchcock, which is a ridiculous comparison. Nomura's films lack the sensationalist thrills and the escapist nature of Hitchcock's films. Instead, they are rather calm, ambiguous character studies in a realist vein whose merits lie in their impressively subtle observations and intelligent dilemmas. Personally, I think Nomura's was especially great at eliciting standout performances from his actors. You won't find performances as natural, multi-layered, and moving as in Nomura's films. I've seen 6 or 7 of his films, and all have been great so far, with Castle of Sand being one of my all-time favorite Japanese films. And coming from Pablo, who's probably seen hundreds of Japanese films, I would say that's a very strong recommendation. One of the very few masterpieces that bring me to tears, even after repeated viewing. So that certainly piques my interest. Little side comments from me here. I guess this little teaser should give you the hint of an idea about his work. If you have any more questions regarding his output, feel free to ask. I'd love to appear once again as a guest on your podcast. However, I'm not currently equipped with proper recording devices. And I'll stop my reading there. But yeah, it was a very well-written little off-the-cuff summary from Pablo. Really appreciate that. He is a student at a film school in Cologne, Germany. And so apparently he doesn't quite have the personal access to the equipment. Although he's talked about maybe renting out a studio. But we just could not get it arranged in time. So I'll look to get him back. We've got a lot of other obscure Japanese films, to say the least, coming up. But anyways, hey, anything in that, William, that you want to react to is as far as his, I know you probably haven't seen nearly as much of Nomura's work, but I felt like Pablo's observations were certainly confirmed by the two earlier films I watched, and even this one itself. What did you think of his comments?
Well, much appreciated, Pablo. Thank you for that on behalf of the listeners, too. This was my first Nomura film, and I still haven't had a chance to check out any of the other ones yet. But like you say, there are a few others on Filmstruck, and I'm really looking forward to it. The collaboration with Hashimoto is, of course, endlessly fascinating. And of course, I can also add, in addition to the films he mentioned, also Ikiru, Throne of Blood, Hidden Fortress, Bad Sleep Well, Sword of Doom, Nodesuka Den, I Live in Fear, films by Naruse, and also, again, many of these Nomura films. And like, that's such a stunning collaborator, and to see that that regularity with Kurosawa also seems to apply in pretty good regard with his regularity with Nomura should be a selling point for almost any even casual fan of Criterion type films, considering the fact that looking at his Letterboxd page, with the exception of the Magnificent Seven remake, which he receives credit for, the films, you know, are all basically first level or second level films that you'd check out. So it's amazing to me that these films haven't caught on nearly as much considering that pedigree. Though I think that it's time for a good renaissance. I think a lot of that's the availability and having Filmstruck opportunities or Hulu, if that's still where they are in Germany, mm-hmm. that we are sitting, like you say, on little nuggets here that we shouldn't take for granted. And though these don't seem to be expiring anytime soon, they're under Criterion Channel branding with the wacky C at the beginning. Mm-hmm. And I think that this is someone who has been rumored or possibly would be a great candidate for an Eclipse-type set. So I mm-hmm. think that kind of thing, you know, we should get on it sooner rather than later. And I'm glad that we had such an enriching email from him. So thank you for that.
Definitely. Yeah, these five films actually seem to have been touring around as a little bit of a retrospective, you know, capsule view of Nomura's career. These are five highlights. There's a few links. I didn't find a ton on the internet, as not all that surprising as far as background links and reviews, but a couple of the reviews I did find spoke of these films and kind of the context of this film in the context of the five other or the four other releases. So it's kind of like this little package of five films that have maybe been licensed for overseas distribution. I'm sure they have been curated somewhat, although again, Pablo mentioned a couple other titles that stand out. So yeah, perhaps there is an Eclipse series set in the offing, but in the meantime, the Filmstruck stream is solid, and these are definitely, you know, some nice fresh perspectives on Japanese film. So, with all those preliminaries aside, that might be a time for novice listeners who really want to go in with pure, unspoiled perspectives to say, okay, I'll hit the pause button, go watch the film, and come back and listen to the rest of the conversation from there. But yeah, so what we have here, like you said, William, is a kind of a marital infidelity. I guess this is a 1970 version of the kind of anonymous, plain-spoken salaryman. He's played by Go Kato, who's a pretty well-regarded actor in a fair number of samurai films. He was in Sword of the Beast and Samurai Rebellion from earlier in this 1960s, alongside bona fide samurai superstars like Toshiro Mifune, Tatsuya Nakadai, and he had to do his own share of sword wielding, and he held his own amongst those heavyweights. Here he's a much more subdued character. He's a travel agent, basically, who commutes back and forth from his little apartment day by day, by bus and by train, and he has a chance encounter one day, one afternoon, coming home from work, with a beautiful young woman that recognizes him. He didn't necessarily notice her until she called him out, but she is a childhood acquaintance from years gone by, and she strikes up a conversation and confirms that, yes, they did know each other some years ago. And out of that grows this little semi-illicit relationship. You know, the basis for why he's unhappy in his marriage is pretty quickly established very early on. He's got a wife who's pretty distracted. She's much more into her little social scene, and she's often not there when he gets home from work. They've been married 10 years. They're childless. Pretty deep in the rut there. So that's kind of the background. But as he gets drawn into first kind of just playing a social call to catch up for old time's sake and find out how his old friend is doing these days, things heat up considerably from there.
That's a pretty good primer, and I think that that would be a better synopsis than the one provided on either Letterboxd or Filmstruck. If you happen to still be listening and do want to see this, Close your eyes when you press play and you're at the Filmstruck menu, because it's a one sentence synopsis that tells you details up to the last 20 minutes of the movie, which is a bit of a frustration. We've all been talking about a lot of the Filmstruck synopses are either ridiculously brief or ridiculously long, but all seem to give details up to the end of the movie for some reason, and I don't really know why. But
and it's a shame, because this I very deliberately went in pretty blind. I just looked it up, hit play, away we go, and I was rather stunned when the movie sort of took the twist that it did towards the end.
Yeah, and I had the unfortunate opposite experience, where I had read the synopsis, even if just because my eyes glanced at it, because it's so brief, and you sit there going, why hasn't... You think that's going to be the inciting incident, and it ends up being the third act. So it's sort of interesting. But I guess, are we in spoilery territory now?
I think so. Let's just go ahead and deal with it.
Great. Well, it's a thriller.
It's a disturbed child thriller. But I think it's very effectively set up, because, you know, I've watched it twice now, and on the rewatch, you sort of see the intimations, and I guess, you know, even from the first time around, I recognize that, you know, this little boy, his name is Ken, he's a 6-year-old kid, and the reason that Hamajima, is that his name? The reason he can get with this woman, Yoshiko, is that her husband died several years ago. And this is the thing. There's not a whole lot of backstory on either of these characters, at least. It emerges little bits here and there throughout the film. But this is a single woman. She herself is an insurance peddler. And I mean literally a peddler. She walks around town selling insurance policies to people, whether these are cold calls or appointments. But one really odd little phenomenon as I was watching the movie, it's like, you know, he's a travel agent booking, you know, hotel and transportation arrangements, and she's selling insurance. And it's like, you know, I could do both of their jobs in like 15 minutes on the internet. You know, I don't really need people to do this. I was just thinking about the human power that, you know, had to go into serving these very menial functions back in the day. But this is also, again, that snapshot of 1960s or late 60s, 1970 Japan, as the country is becoming a little bit more prosperous. I mean, these are not people living in any kind of poverty. They're not quite the, you know, semi-upper middle class of some of the later Ozu films, but everybody's doing pretty well. But there's a certain hollowness or a little emptiness that's going on in their lives that they're looking to fulfill, as well as materialism and distractions and pop culture kind of dominate the attention span. There still seems to be something missing. I guess that is one interpretation of the title, The Shadow Within. But Ken, like a lot of other children, doesn't really take too well to this new man coming into his life. He knows that he's not his dad, but who is he? And from the adult man's perspective, who is this kid?
I really love the aspects of the film that revolve around their professions. There are a number of montages of them as they've sort of started to kindle whatever sort of romance is developing between them. It shows them in their day-to-day lives, basically separate from one another, and there's nothing boring about it. There's this wonderful, wonderful music that is, you know, echoes of Michel Legrand or something.
Yeah, a little swanky jazz lounge stuff.
By Yasushi Akutagawa, who also has credits for Fires on the Plain, Gate of Hell, and a few other films that I think we'll probably, you know, have people who know. And the music in it accompanying these montages is so gentle, but then it's contrasted with this very realistic and very lovingly private sexuality between them as their relationship really becomes a romantic and sexual one. It seems like it's more an affair about the sexual aspect in a lot of ways too, with them really staving off this prospect of eventually marrying themselves and him divorcing his wife somehow. And having that, it just feels very refreshing that even these people who have these boring job montages can have these cinematic, rich sexual experiences outside of that. Mm-hmm. And I think it's a level of detail given to quote unquote boring characters that you don't really even see in a lot of films, but it does seem to be pretty popular in this era. I mean, it's not that dissimilar in terms of the approach that you might find in some of the new American films of around the same time, where you're really treating cinematically a lot of regular people's situations. And there's also echoes of a lot of what's going on in Europe, like I said, and in France with the music and a lot of the approach. There's a number of visual effects that happen in the flashbacks that that seem to grate the film in this distorted filter that I really was shocked by. It seems like a computer effect. It could be an early video effect. I'm not sure how else it could have been generated, but it would time out to that kind of era, I think, of technology. And it provides this multi-layered aspect because we have so many things all happening at once. And like we say, there's almost a genre change in the film too. You mentioned that watching it a second time, you really see the hints of it. And of course, knowing the spoiler, you spend the whole time going, when is this going to happen? This kid keeps whipping out knives. But
right.
But that basically the thriller twist is that this child will eventually possibly maybe try to kill this man who is coming in as his surrogate father. And there's another twist on top of that I'm sure we'll get to. But that's basically where we're heading towards in the third act. But it seems like this is a film that has its cake and eats it too, because that aspect doesn't feel like it's such a huge shift or it's that it's unearned in any way. But you really do get for the first 45, 50 minutes this really nice drama about a man exploring this other romance in his life. And you do feel sort of supportive of him. I don't think the film sort of satirizes the culture of his wife, who is basically someone who gives lessons in paper flower arrangements, I guess.
Mm-hmm.
And that these women gossip and are gossiping about, of course, the hot button topics of the time, like Sharon Tate, which is the topic in every movie we watch now. Like,
yes.
Always comes up.
Away from it, yeah, right.
But yeah, that satire is pretty prevalent, I think, in the way that it kind of shows the negative light of these housewives.
Yeah, and it's both played off for the comic effect, but it's also kind of serious. I mean, this guy who is going about his job, doing his duty, being an upstanding, you know, productive Japanese man, he comes home and his wife is attractive and their lifestyle is comfortable, but there's no spark, there's no bond, there's no energy, and she seems rather oblivious to that. I mean, her life is full enough, but then, you know, you sort of get the sense a little bit later on when she's trying to sort of seduce him and she thinks maybe we should have children and she's trying to, you know, get him aroused. Well, sorry, honey, he's kind of already spent his supply in his previous encounter there. But you get into that kind of that 10-year itch, so to speak, the ennui or the settledness or the resignation that kind of overwhelm a marriage at that stage if the purpose, whatever it was that drew them together, has been kind of fizzling out for a while. And again, so there is some, I think, some genuine and empathic social commentary going on there. And then, you know, the Eros, the scenes that you mentioned earlier, I think really are quite moving. You know, I mean, there is some skin showing here. There is some erotic entertainment value, if you will. And it's funny, for all of the mounds of flesh that were on display in Beyond the Valley of the Dolls, this is a much sexier movie here.
Oh, absolutely. Yeah. This is a movie that feels like a real situation.
Yeah. And the yearning and the buildup and then the release, you know, I mean, it's certainly not graphic, but it's the emotions and the palpable energy that they're putting into this relationship and they're experiencing together is, Yeah, I'd say it's pretty convincing.
And so well performed with, I think, the two leads doing something that happens a lot in Japanese cinema, which is showing repression within a character.
Yes.
There's so many Japanese films where you have a situation where a woman, a housewife, or a expected-to-be wife is hiding her tears, or is hiding her pain in some way, or the man seems a bit emasculated in his ability to, we can barely speak with his wife about, and it's not like, again, it's not she's a terrible person, it's just that the spark is gone, and that they don't have much to talk with each other about, and it's something very rote, and going through the motions about their relationship. And I think we're getting a much more naturalistic approach to that than we might find in earlier Japanese films. And I think both of these actors, and also the third lead, his wife, and even the fourth lead, the child, all bring really great natural performances. I really like scenes of just watching him have dinner at his mistress's house with the yes. son. I think that it shows this really nice side of this life that's not at all rushed, which is why I think that when the fact that the film seems to have such gentle stakes, even though you're talking about infidelity, there's a bit of a realism to that, because sometimes you end up in a situation where you don't really realize the stakes of it while you're in it. Your body is just following some impulse, and that's sort of what's happening here, and it sort of sneaks up that impulse, which has various sorts of metaphors with the rats that seem to infest the apartment and the rat poison cakes that he accidentally eats as he starts to think that maybe this boy is trying to kill him, that maybe he is another rat that's infesting his home. There's just little layers like that, but the stakes grow in this very gentle and realistic way to a truly cinematic and quote-unquote basically like nuts ending. That the last third of this film has horror elements, with the boy appearing in multiple places around the house, with huge weapons and in heightened color schemes that seem out of Houseu or something.
Right, right. The lighting schemes, the kid. I mean, the scene you're specifically referring to, where he finds himself locked in the house. It's a little bit of a shack, even though they're kind of in an urban environment overall. His lover's house seems to be a ways off the beaten path. It's back in a little wooded section. Maybe this is kind of a lower rent district where a single woman would have to live, because she just can't afford to live in the posh new apartments closer to the urban center. But yeah, as he's running from window to window, I mean, it's physically impossible for this little kid to be positioned where he is, from one wall to the window to the window to the other. But he's like right there, and it definitely gives a little goosebumps as you're kind of like, whoa, what is going on?
Well, go ahead.
Well, no, and so yeah, so you really have this twist, but all along there, you also have the growing warmth of this, you know, very pleasant little domestic scene. The man is finding this family that he didn't even know he really missed, but the idea of having a beautiful woman who loves him, who supports him, appreciates him, they have that spark, they have that vibrancy. And now there's a little boy, and he can make models together, and he can help him build a swing, and they can take drives in the woods. What'd you think of that little idyllic passage and the autumn leaves and all of that? I thought, well, that was a very lovely little scene there. And again, you know, I'm not used to seeing that little kind of domestic tranquil bliss in Japanese films of this era. I mean, you certainly see a lot of beautiful nature shots, but it's often in, you know, Zatoichi films or other samurai type. This just felt so like gauzy, postcardy, Hallmarky almost. But I liked it because it just sort of stood out, this unique little moment there.
Absolutely unique. And it's led up to in this very brief encountery sort of way, where his wife's like, oh, we have another obligation we have to do, and it's on the one day they'd already planned to make the trip. And you see him get a little shaken up, and you as an audience very likely are going, oh no, I want him to go on that trip. Like, you start to sort of root for the situation, which is that, again, that brief encounter syndrome, where there's an escapism in watching these people have this idyllic life, even if it's just driving into the forest. But that's where things start to go awry, when the boy damages his car and starts to... We see an actual act of rebellion. The film often plays this very popular trope in the Disturbed Child movie, where the kid's doing something and you think, oh, and he's going to use this knife against me. And no, he's just chopping wood to make a swing. Mm-hmm. And the bait and switch keeps happening. But
right. We
get a pretty definitive thing that, no, this boy has some aggression that he's laying out. Which,
well, you know, mom and her boyfriend are screwing over in the trees, and he can't find them.
It's a bit negligent, right?
Exactly. So he's throwing rocks at this guy's rental, and I'm like, I just got done driving a rental car through Washington D.C. for 4 days, and I'm like, oh my gosh, this kid's throwing rocks at the rental car. There goes the deposit right there. So, anyways, little side notes, but yeah, it was a moment of outrage, and so this little. Sort of semi-paradise situation that the man thinks he's getting himself into, there's already cracks at the seams.
And as it starts to crumble, where we get to the point where enough murder attempts have happened and he's tried to basically back out of the relationship on behalf of this boy, saying, I can't be, this boy's gonna kill me. And the mother says, oh, he's just shy around strangers and it'll be fine. And there's eventually this climactic moment that, you know, you keep seeing these things where the boy's sleeping just feet from where they're sleeping together. And eventually one of these nighttime encounters. Oh, yeah?
And they're having quiet sex, you know, so they're trying not to get too, you know, frisky, too loud. And you're not sure, is the boy really sleeping or is he kind of watching him with one eye open? So it is. I mean, and it is this kind of, you know, he knows that he's transgressing. He's kind of in somebody else's territory here, and yet, you know, he doesn't want to deny himself or his lover that relationship. And it's as many, you know, mixed marriages do. It's like, well, the kids will get used to it eventually.
Well,
you could
appreciate that. I think that it's very easy. Like I'm saying about how I really appreciated the exploration of sexuality of these regular people. It's a sexuality exploration of a businessman and a single widowed mother. And that's something you really don't get to see play. And usually if you do see that relationship, it'll be Oscar bait melodrama version.
Right.
It won't
be. Or she's some kind of harpy who's trying to drive him to leave his wife. And she's like, no, I know I can't have you. I don't want it to look like I stole you away from her. I'll wait 5 years. I'll wait 10 years. You know, I mean, they're both trying to do the right thing, but they're in this really kind of awful dilemma. And that does kind of set the stage for the big twist of the movie. So do we want to kind of
Basically have a double twist because our hero eventually fights back on one of these alleged murder attempts and nearly kills the child.
Right. And, you know, and it's funny because I've talked about my work and treatment and social services and working with aggressive and self-injuring children and people with some pretty severe behaviors. And it's like, that dude really kind of went off on this kid. I mean, I have had to disarm children with dangerous objects when they're coming at me. So I'm not like that hard-boiled detective who says a six-year-old kid can't conceive of killing someone. Oh, I have met those children, okay? However, there are ways of doing that when they're that young, that small, that you don't have to be grabbing him by the neck and pinning him to the floor, which is basically what happens here. So, but it is a very dramatic, very intense moment. And it's almost immediately after they've probably had, I think, the most passionate lovemaking scene, because this is the first time he's agreed to spend a full night with her. You know, he's always had, they've had their encounters, and then he finds a way to get back home, and she's kind of pleaded with him to say, I want to have that experience that your wife does. I want to spend the night with you. And so he agrees to do that. But before the night is through, their idyllic dream has been completely shattered.
Well, sure, and it's very interesting that, you know, he agrees that he'll want to foster this child as if it was his own, mm-hmm. and they consummate this act, which is the, you know, the root of all creation and procreation.
Right.
Immediately after, attempts to commit infanticide, and as if maybe he needed a different kid all along. He needed his own child because what he's longing for was something he never had at home. And maybe as much as he likes this little boy, maybe it's not going to be the one that works out. But where we're heading towards is all of these this backstory. So there's these flashbacks I had mentioned, which
detail that's kind of a solarizing technique.
I think you're right.
Monkey's head uses it, and I think it was used in Easy Rider.
Oh yes. So that technique and is used for these flashbacks, which are happening in this sort of seaside village decades ago, as the protagonist is a child and doling out minor information about his backstory as the film goes, but showing to a certain point that his life is being echoed by his current experience, that he had a single mother who had a man in her life that came in and was the uncle, basically, and that these experiences have paralleled, and we're heading towards the twist where, in the police investigation that follows, we have the revelation that he did, as a child, kill this uncle, basically. And that's basically the movie ends right there, and the kid's on his swing in the snow, and it's over. And
the man is presumably headed, if not to prison, certainly to trial, and his life is in shatters. His real wife, his actual wife, has gone back to live with her mother. Everything's blown up. He will never be able to undo the damage that this one terrible incident has inflicted on not only his life, but his lover's and his wife's. The kid will kind of rebound and do what he does. Who knows exactly what's going on inside Ken's, locked away little mind there. But it is. And so, again, you've got this meditation on the blended family, the child's struggle to accept the legitimacy of a stepfather in particular. That seems to be a more common theme rather than step-parents in general. And you've also got some comparisons between, maybe wartime or early post-war period of Japanese history. You see it's a much more of a rustic setting, more of a village life that people were living when the protagonist was a child, versus the much more urban cosmopolitan situation that we've got going on in the contemporary story. So again, it's just a very skillful blending of a lot of different perspectives, I think, makes this more than just kind of a little incidental trifle. This is a film with some depth, and again, very well-crafted filmmaking. Smooth, jazzy soundtrack. I'm sure I'll be throwing some clips, at least at the beginning and end. Maybe I'll throw a sample or two in the midst as well, because there's some pretty cool little moments.
Oh, I love it. It's great. No, it truly reminds me of the romantic themes in Young Girls of Rushmore or something. Mm-hmm. And it has this beautiful quality. And I think the film has a lot of depth almost because of the tonal shift, where this ending, which in another film handled more clumsily, could be a sort of shabby, unearned shock, and probably a bit problematic in the way that it might seem to imply that if you have some sort of abuse or trauma in your life, if there's some sort of echo in your childhood, that you will have to then revisit that echo as an adult and you can't escape it. It's sort of a sort of defeating thing for some people to experience. That, I mean, if you had, for any reason, had the unfortunate circumstance where in your childhood innocence you murdered somebody, and you saw the echoes of this in your later life, you would hope that the violence wouldn't immediately have to come back out. And I think the film does present a bit of a complicated view of it, even though it doesn't answer any questions, because the film almost ends. He basically reveals, and we show the flashback of that murder with this jazzy music and the solarization and everything. And it feels very earned. And I think that it strides a nice line between entertainment and insight psychologically. And I think it's a fun watch, if you can call it that. I think it's a very enjoyable film. Not very long. Paced very gently, in the way that it reaches its climax, but never feels like it's outstaying any of its welcome. And if you are now completely spoiled and haven't seen it, I hope you would watch it.
Yeah. I think even if we've given away the store and you've decided to listen because you just dig listening to William and I rap movies. Well, okay, that's fine. But give it a watch, even if you see every twist that's coming. I think you're going to find plenty to appreciate. So, yeah, and I also appreciate that it doesn't kind of overstate its importance. This isn't a message movie that's trying to explain the, you know, the nature or the inevitable outcome of childhood traumas. But it does raise those kind of perplexing questions. Was this guy projecting some of his own, you know, repressed guilt onto this poor kid? Or was he blowing some of the child's very reasonable struggles to adjust to this new man coming into his relationship with his mom, and reading too many sinister motives into all of that? So, yeah, a solid film, a good hour and 40 minutes or so. I think we can keep the conversation brief tonight, and hopefully people will give this one a look.
Yeah, and I'm looking forward to seeing more of his films now that I've had my first taste. This film feels like a wonderful short story, which basically a 90-minute film probably more equates to a short story than a novel in general.
Oh, yeah, absolutely.
Which is one of the issues in adaptation anyway. People tend to do too much with too little time. But you can imagine this being one in a collection of page turners. And if the rest of the scripts, which these co-writers, the famous one, Shinobu Hashimoto, and also Seicho Matsumoto, who also has a lot of credits on Zero Focus, The Demon, was it Castle of Sand, that these writers seem to have a pretty good handle on this kind of nugget that we are craving in Filmstruck. So I think we're in for some good films, and I think that for the ones you haven't seen, I think you will like them more too.
Yeah, yeah. I also wanted to point out the actress. Oh, what is her name?
It's Shima Iwashita, who is Harakiri, Autumn Afternoon, Double Suicide, has a lot of great credits, and is terrific.
Yeah, excellent. Yeah, she was the bride in Autumn Afternoon. So if you've got that image kind of burned into your consciousness, here you see her playing.
Also, I think in Scandalous Adventures of Burai-kan, which you had just talked about, I believe.
Thank you for drawing that connection. Mm-hmm. Okay, I think we're going to wrap it up really quickly then. Our true next episode is going to be another visit of Japan, Nagase Oshima, talking about a guy who brings the erotic element into his films. Nagase Oshima is the man who left his will on film. So that will be coming up very soon. And give us a listen for episode 23 next time we come around. Thanks for tuning in, everybody. Bye-bye.
Bye.